A personal story inside the caravan, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Every migrant family from Central America has a reason for fleeing, and it's usually based in fear.
One time, she was walking home, and this guy stopped her and said, "Put out your hand." And he put three bullets in her palm and said they'd be used to kill her.
Our special collaboration with PBS Frontline, one family story of migration and separation at the border. Plus, Nobel Peace Prize winner Oscar Arias is accused of sexually assaulting four women. One of them says she feels a moral obligation to speak out.
Women like me, who have the sort of privilege and the security to be able to stand up and speak out, really ought to do so.
That's all coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Oscar Arias may not be a household name in the U.S., but his status in Latin America can't be understated. He was president of Costa Rica twice, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1987 for brokering peace among Central American countries embroiled in civil wars. This is Arias in 2001 at the Nobel Centennial Symposia in Oslo, Norway, calling on the audience to fight injustice.
And thus continue to give support to people who are struggling to bring light into a world that at times seems indeed very dark.
But this week, the legacy of Oscar Arias was called into serious question when a woman accused him of sexual assault. His accuser is a peace activist and physician in Costa Rica. She says Arias assaulted her in 2014 and that the Me Too movement emboldened her to make a formal complaint to authorities. That news prompted three more women to come forward with their own stories of Arias assaulting them. Emma Daly is one of the women who spoke out this week. She now works for Human Rights Watch. I know this is not easy to discuss, but we and clearly you feel it's important to talk about. When were you working with Oscar Arias and in what capacity?
So it was in the late 1980s and 1990 in Central America. I was a reporter for an English language weekly in Costa Rica called the Tico Times, and I was also a stringer for Reuters. And probably from the end of 1988 through to the middle of 1990, I was covering the Central American peace process and covering Oscar Arias a lot. And, you know, it's a small country. It was a very intense news story. And so I spent a lot of time following him around, sitting outside summit meetings, trying to find out what was happening with the Central American peace process. So I knew him quite well in a professional context, and we'd always had perfectly normal relations until this one moment in Managua, I think, in 1990.
Can you tell us what happened? Like, what was this incident?
So the incident is extremely clear to me in my memory. The details around it are a little bit hazy, but I think that it was in Managua, either during the Nicaraguan elections in February of that year, or when Violeta Chamorro took power in April of that year. But it was a major news event, and I'm pretty sure that it happened in the lobby of a hotel, I think the Intercontinental in Managua, which is where everyone used to gather on these kinds of occasions. Mm. So there were a lot of people, a lot of journalists, diplomats in this space, and I saw Oscar Arias coming towards me, and so I called out to him and asked him a question. And, you know, I very clearly remember him stopping, looking at me, then reaching out with one hand, touching my chest and pulling his hand down between my breasts, and then saying something like, "Oh, you're not wearing a bra," and then walking off.
This was in the middle of a hotel lobby.
Yeah, surrounded by lots of people. You know, I was so, and in the moment, I was so stunned. All I could say was, "Yes, I am." Like, as if whether or not I was wearing a bra was really the point. But in the moment, I kind of froze, and that's what I said. And then right afterwards, a woman who I think was an American journalist, but not somebody that I knew, said to me, "I saw what he did to you. You know, if you want to do something, I'll back you up," or something like that. And I just sort of brushed it off and said, "Thanks, no, you know, it's fine," and just carried on with whatever I was doing.
Were there any signs with Oscar Arias prior to this incident in this hotel lobby that suggested he might be capable of something like this?
Not that I experienced directly. You know, it's very hard because I don't want to talk about things that were sort of second or third hand. I mean, some people will say that he had a reputation in that way, but I hadn't witnessed anything. I hadn't experienced anything to make me think that he would treat me in that way.
It sounds like you've been replaying this incident, and certainly in the last couple of days, but has this been kind of on your mind ever since then?
Not ever since then. I mean, I told people at the time. I told my then boyfriend, who was also a reporter, and I told, you know, other friends and colleagues. And over the years, I've told other people. You know, my husband says that I tell that story to people whenever Arias's name comes up. And then what happened really around Me Too, obviously, I talked about it again, because what happened when Me Too first surfaced was that lots of women sat around saying, oh, what were your Me Too moments? And we traded stories about things that had happened to us, you know, while working. And I even, in fact, actually posted on a friend of mine's Facebook page, I made reference to one of mine having involved a president and Nobel laureate. So, you know, it's not something that's kind of hung over my life. I mean, I think I thought it was, you know, really the price of doing business in a sexist place at a sexist time and in a male-dominated profession.
The American colleague who came up to you in the hotel lobby right after this incident and said, if you need a witness, I'm there for you. What were you really feeling about that? I mean, did a part of you want to pursue some kind of justice?
I think the first part of me thought, oh, that's right, you're American. They do things differently there. I mean, it didn't even occur to me that you could complain about something like that. Who would I have complained to? If I had, I think they would have just laughed at me. Even now, I think women who get groped find it difficult to complain about it. And a lot of times, you know, there will be a response that's like, oh, she was just groped. I remember that happened when Lara Logan was horrifically, horrifically assaulted in Tahrir Square in Egypt.
Yeah.
And the first reports were that she'd been grabbed and touched. And, you know, a couple of people responded by saying, you know, she was groped. Stop making such a big deal about it. It then turned out that what happened to her was horrifically violent and appalling. But there was that notion that, like, well, if she'd just been groped, that's really not a big deal. And if we're still thinking that now, I mean, back in 1990, we really didn't feel that, or I almost didn't feel like I had the right not to be groped.
I'm speaking with Emma Daly, one of the women who's accused Oscar Arias Sanchez of sexual assault. How has Me Too, the whole movement, played a role in your accusation?
I think it's just made me more aware, really, of the need to speak out. What happened to me in this particular instance is that a reporter reached out to me saying, I understood that you worked in Costa Rica and that you might have something to say, after the first accusation about Arias came out. Mm. And I consulted my husband and some colleagues. I knew I was going to talk to the reporter, but I had to think really long and hard about whether I wanted to use my name. And I think that the main lesson of Me Too is that women like me, who have the sort of privilege and the security to be able to stand up and speak out, really ought to do so, because there are so many other women who really aren't in that kind of position. There are women who've risked a huge amount to speak out. And so I really feel like I owe it to them and to all the other women who can't speak out for fear of losing their job, for fear of being ostracized, for fear of upsetting their families, for fear of, you know, physical retaliation. I really owe it to them to speak out because I'm able to.
What has been the response from Oscar Arias, and what is your response to his response?
He and his lawyers have not responded to the subsequent allegations. The first accusation that came to light against him is actually a criminal complaint. And there his lawyer and he have said that he'll defend himself in a court of law, which is as it should be. And I obviously have no idea what happened between him and Alexandra Arce. I do hope that her allegations are investigated thoroughly and fairly, and that if her case goes to court, that both she and Oscar Arias are treated fairly and are both able to make their case in a courtroom. So he hasn't responded to me, and that's fine. You know, it's his right. I also suspect that he might not remember this incident, because if for him it was somehow normal or okay to reach out and touch somebody in that way, maybe he doesn't remember it. To me, it was an extremely memorable and humiliating moment. But I wouldn't be surprised if he has no memory of it at all.
You know, up until now, as you well know, Oscar Arias has enjoyed an almost saintly reputation, not just in Costa Rica, but all of Latin America, a lot of the world, too. Did that reputation give you pause when you were considering coming forward?
The work that Oscar Arias did in fomenting the Central American peace process was incredibly, incredibly important. I feel sure that he saved countless lives through ending those wars. The fact that he has an incredible professional legacy doesn't give him the right to touch other people against their will.
I was struck by one of the things you said about why you came forward now, kind of standing up and remembering that there are lots of women who have experienced this. Have other women in Costa Rica or elsewhere, maybe women who have experienced sexual assault in the past, have they reached out to you? And have you gotten any criticism?
I've seen one comment on a Facebook page, somebody I don't know, who said that something similar had happened to her. But I also have had, you know, lots of responses, you know, on Twitter, on Facebook, the vast majority very supportive. But I haven't been through every sort of single comment. And, you know, I probably won't. And, you know, I think what's also difficult in these situations is, you know, as I said, I don't know what happened between him and Alexandra Arce. I only know what happened to me. But I think part of the reason why I felt that it was worth speaking up about what happened to me, which is obviously significantly less severe than the allegations that Alexandra Arce made about what happened to her. Nonetheless, I feel as if what happened to me and what allegedly happened to her are on some kind of continuum of bad behavior, that you can see the possible links between one kind of behavior and the other. And I think that's another reason why I felt a need to speak out. It's my experience seemed somehow relevant to the allegations that she was making. And then the other point I would make is that, you know, I was a reporter for many years, so I spent much of my professional life asking people to tell me really difficult stories and to share intimate and painful details of their life. So when someone asked the same of me, I really felt I had a responsibility to respond.
Emma Daly, one of four women accusing Oscar Arias, the former Costa Rican president and Nobel Prize laureate, of assault. We reached out to one of the lawyers on the defense team for Arias, Gloriana Valladares Navas. I asked her to respond to Emma Daly's accusations.
First of all, what we have to clarify is that the case is under investigation. The stage in which we are at this moment forbids us to refer to the details or reveal anything about the procedures. So as much as we would like to comment on the case, the law limits us from doing so.
He has said to the New York Times through his lawyer, part of your representation, I deny categorically the accusations made against me. Do you stand behind his response?
That is not accurate. What has been saying is that we're respectful from our judicial system and we're not referring specifics about the case.
All right, we'll leave it there. Gloriana Valladares Navas, the lawyer for Oscar Arias Sanchez, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We'll keep covering the Oscar Arias story as it unfolds. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. The crisis in Venezuela took a dramatic new twist this week. You may have seen pictures of a multi-lane bridge blocked with giant shipping containers on their sides. That bridge connects Venezuela to the city of Cúcuta, Colombia. And that barricade was ordered by Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro as a way to stop international food aid from entering his country. Journalist Luke Taylor is in Cúcuta.
It's previously been very successful and has a lot of money due to Venezuela's boom, and it serves as a commercial hub. In recent years, however, it's not doing so well on account of Venezuela having plunged into this economic and political crisis, and it now serves as a major route for contraband smuggling between Venezuela and Colombia. And there's a parallel economy that sprung up, for example, Venezuelan women who sell their hair in order to survive and buy bus tickets.
Wow.
Or people who are just buying basic supplies such as toilet roll, for example, or ibuprofen and other basic medicines too. Particularly at the border, it's very chaotic. The scenes are both upsetting and, yeah, ones of chaos too.
So what are you hearing from people that you've met around the bridge?
People that I've met around the bridge are very disappointed and angry and resentful at the fact that Maduro is blocking the aid in. People are literally starving of hunger. Malnutrition is dire levels and every day getting worse.
You met somebody named Dalia Guerrero. Where is she from? What did she tell you?
Dalia Guerrero is from Maracay in Venezuela. She comes frequently to Colombia to buy food for her two babies, for her two children, sorry, diapers and those kind of basic supplies. And she was upset and said it was a disgrace that the aid could not enter into Venezuela from Colombia.
The Venezuelan government doesn't let us work, and they don't let us be free. And now they don't let other countries help us. But I have faith that soon all this will change for me and for all Venezuelans.
I suspect some of the other people you spoke with, if they're Venezuelan, were also kind of counting heavily on this aid coming across this bridge that is now barricaded.
Uncertainty was the key word that a lot of people said to me. Uncertainty whether it will come tomorrow or the next day or where will it come in. There's a lot of hope that it will pass over.
That was Luke Taylor reporting from Cúcuta, Colombia, on the border with Venezuela. You heard him say there how Venezuelan women are now selling their hair for money. That hair then gets made into wigs. That is one of the most vivid illustrations I've heard yet of Venezuela's catastrophic economic collapse. And yet, we're talking about a country that used to be one of the wealthiest in the world. So what happened? The World's Jason Margolis looks back at another economic collapse in Venezuela, one that helped pave the way for the election of Hugo Chavez in 1998.
This is Caracas. Protests, riots, looting, gunfire, somewhere between a few hundred and 3,000 people dead, mostly at the hands of a brutal crackdown by government security forces. And this was 1989. Economist Francisco Rodriguez was a college student back then in Caracas.
It was a surprise to all of us. The Venezuela in which I grew up was a very confident nation, and it trusted its democracy and it valued its democratic system.
Venezuela was also rich, very rich, the wealthiest nation in Latin America.
The city of Caracas, capital of Venezuela, is enjoying a prosperity boom unparalleled in the history of South America. But where does all the money come from? The answer lies under the ground, where rich oil deposits ensure a steady revenue.
And so, Venezuela, with the world's largest oil reserves, hummed along until...
The price of oil collapses significantly in the 1980s.
Javier Corrales is a political scientist at Amherst College in Massachusetts. When oil prices plummeted, Venezuela was suddenly deep in debt. To get assistance from the International Monetary Fund, the country's leaders pursued market-oriented solutions. The government cut back on social programs, eliminated price controls on gas and other consumer goods, and privatized state-owned companies. It was all done to try and make the economy run more efficiently. Corrales says it didn't work.
One theory is that the medicine that was applied was the wrong medicine, so you made the patient worse. An alternative argument is that they didn't have enough time to apply them medicine.
When the government cut subsidies for gas, the cost to ride the bus rose 30%, and people quickly took to the streets in 1989. Venezuela's government also overvalued its currency exchange rate for a prolonged period. Basically, it made the Venezuelan bolivar artificially strong. This benefited Venezuela's rich. It allowed them to cheaply buy U.S. dollars and set up foreign bank accounts to shield themselves from higher inflation or economic crisis back home. The result? A lot of capital left Venezuela. Economist Francisco Rodriguez, with Torino Economics, says there was another reason to prop up the Venezuelan bolivar, to give the currency more spending power abroad.
Why? Because they wanted to appeal to voters, because they wanted to say imported goods are cheap.
Yes, a strong currency allowed Venezuelans to buy cheap imports, but it also stifled domestic growth. If you can import cars or sofas for less than building them at home, there's no economic incentive to develop your own industry. Michael Shifter is president of the Inter-American Dialogue, a think tank in Washington.
The big mistake was not diversifying the economy and being so dependent and so reliant on the petroleum sector. That's virtually the only thing that Venezuela produces.
And on top of all of that, Shifter says corruption in Venezuela was rampant.
Everything, everybody.
No huge surprise, inequality and resentment grew.
It would have been much wiser in retrospect to have had a more attention on targeted social policies in the 1990s. There was a desire for change, and especially for the poor, they wanted a voice, and Chavez, I think, very effectively tapped into that desire.
Hugo Chavez was a leftist who appealed to Venezuela's poor.
En Venezuela tiene su hora, y es que llegó la hora del pueblo.
That's a political ad from Chavez's winning presidential campaign in 1998. Chavez basically says, in Venezuela, it's time for the people. At the time, he was a young, charismatic military man, a third-party candidate in a historically two-party system. As president, Chavez also ran Venezuela's economy almost entirely on oil, but he benefited from higher prices. He invested a lot of the profits into social programs to help the poor, and many Venezuelans loved him for it. But there was also a lot of cronyism and inept management within his administration. Chavez died in office in 2013 of cancer. His successor, Nicolas Maduro, stepped in and ran the economy into the ground. Michael Shifter says Venezuela has now come full circle.
The problems today are magnified, but they're the same kind. You know, the corruption is monumental, the mismanagement is monumental. And so it's interesting to reflect on the same themes being touched on by Juan Guaido, the interim president of Venezuela, as was touched on by Hugo Chavez 20 years ago.
And while the problems in Venezuela today are considerably worse, Shifter says there are economic lessons for whatever government comes next in Caracas. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. A mother in the U.S. waits for her son as he makes his way north in the migrant caravan.
Veronica says her chest physically hurts, wondering how he's doing, whether he's eaten. She hasn't seen him since she left El Salvador more than a year ago.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. A caravan of around 2,000 migrants is now gathering in a Mexican border town in the hope of entering the United States. They'll attempt to cross from Piedras Negras in Mexico to Eagle Creek, Texas. It's the first time a large group of migrants has come to the border with Texas instead of California. They're in a temporary shelter guarded by military police in riot gear. One Honduran man, Miguel Sanchez, says he's determined to enter the U.S. in search of a better life.
Yo digo que está mal, Trump, que no está bien de la mente.
I think Trump's got it wrong. He's not okay in the head. We come to find work, but he thinks that because there are gangs in Central America, that we come here to commit crime. But no, no, that's not why we're here. We come to work and to do our best. And even if he puts up his wall, that's not going to stop us.
We've reported many times on the so-called migrant caravans from Central America and on unaccompanied minors crossing from Mexico into the U.S. Last fall, The World's Monica Campbell set out to get an up-close and personal look at what it's like to experience migration like that by following one family for months. We're devoting the rest of our show today to that story of one boy and his mom and their journey. Monica's reporting is in collaboration with our partners at PBS Frontline and their podcast, The Frontline Dispatch.
It's November, and I'm crossing the border into Tijuana. I'm looking for a kid I'd heard about from El Salvador who came up in the migrant caravan. He's 15 and alone and waiting for a chance to enter the U.S. and ask for asylum. There's a U.S. helicopter overhead and Mexican soldiers and police around. And there's this plaza, and a group of migrants are gathered around a man with a notebook.
1231, Guatemala.
He's calling out numbers from the notebook. It's a way of creating a line of sorts for the thousands of migrants here. If your number's called, you can go up to the border to U.S. officials and ask for asylum. But the kid I'm looking for, his name's Vladdy, isn't here. He can't come here. If he does, Mexican officials can pick him up and even deport him because he's a teenager on his own without papers. So he avoids this place. He's holed up in a shelter nearby.
So I'm heading to the youth shelter where Vladdy is staying. And
the shelter's this small concrete building on a busy street. It's just 10 minutes from the border. I find Vladdy in the courtyard hanging out.
Mucho gusto. It's nice to meet you. Un gusto conocerle. ¿Cómo va?
He's slim with brown eyes, wearing a gray sweatshirt, basketball shorts. He's got a baseball hat, one of those flat-brimmed ones turned to the side. The clothes are all donated, but he likes them. They're trendy street clothes. This shelter's for teenagers like him. Many of them came up in the same caravan he did. He shows me around.
Area for taking a shower and washing up. There's a small garden, this parking lot.
And there are certain rules here he's got to follow.
No smoking.
Consumir bebidas alcohólicas.
No alcohol.
Hay una hora límite para regresar a las 6:30 cuando uno está lejos. Ya si uno quiere
salir. By 6:30, if they want to go out, they need to ask permission.
The rules are no joke. This part of Mexico can be dangerous. It's no place for a kid like Vladdy on his own. A couple of weeks after I meet him, two kids staying at the same shelter were found murdered not far away. Their bodies were found on the side of the road. But El Salvador wasn't safe either. He starts telling me why he left.
Porque fui amenazado por las pandillas.
He says because he was threatened by the gangs.
Ya uno que ya tiene 14, 15 años así ya corre peligro, porque ya las pandillas lo piensan a querer involucrar, a lo quieren poner a postear cosas así, pues.
He said that when you turn 14 or 15, where he lives in El Salvador, then you're ready to be recruited. You feel that pressure to be recruited, and that's just a fact of life of where he lives. ¿Y qué más?
Y pues empieza a amenazarnos que va a matar a nuestra familia si no nos unimos o si no nos mata a nosotros.
He says that they'll start to threaten, that they were threatening us. They said they would kill us, kill out my family if we didn't join them.
But he didn't join the gang. His mom told him to join the migrant caravan instead. So he left El Salvador, along with his grandmother, who went with him as far as Tijuana.
Pues los primeros dos días que empezamos a caminar.
He says the first few days walking were some of the toughest.
Pues yo traía un par de zapatos de Salvador, pero ya los boté porque se me arruinaron. De ahí, tercer par de zapatos y pues contando unas chinas sería cuarto.
So he's on his fourth pair of shoes.
It was scary at times. At one point, a man from Honduras hitched a ride on a crowded truck and fell off and died. The caravan gained momentum as it moved north. People kept joining, many of them planning to seek asylum in the U.S. And it all blew up in the news. President Trump started tweeting about it and said he'd send troops to keep the migrants out.
I'm not letting them in. They're not coming in. All right? They're not coming in. We're going to do whatever we have to. They're not coming in.
Vladdy knows what the president is saying about the migrants.
Pues eso es discriminación, pues lo que está haciendo el presidente de los Estados Unidos. Él es hijo de, creo que su madre era emigrante. Y pues,
he says it's discrimination. He says Trump. He says that Trump also comes from a family of immigrants, that his wife is an immigrant. But Vladdy's still determined to cross the border and enter the U.S. Someone's waiting there for him. His mom. I meet his mom, Veronica Aguilar, at the house she's staying in near San Francisco with a couple who took her in. She fled El Salvador a year before Vladdy did.
A causa del papá de mi hijo, yo ya había tenido problemas con las pandillas.
desde que yo decidí dejar de ir a verlo a la al penal o a la detención.
Vladdy's dad was in prison for murder. He was in a gang. She tried to cut off ties with him, but he said, "You're being disloyal and keeping my son from me."
Ellas tienen que ir o las matan. Porque ellos, los pandilleros, casi la mayoría que están detenidos, tienen obligadas a sus mujeres, aunque ellas no quieran ir.
She says if you're with a gang member who's locked up, you've got to stick with them or else, like being married to the mob. One time, she was walking home and this guy stopped her and said, "Put out your hand." And he put 3 bullets in her palm and said they'd be used to kill her.
Fue un día que me pusieron la pistola en la cabeza.
She said at one point, someone came and put a gun to her head on the street.
It's one bad thing after another. I read her asylum application later and realize she didn't even tell me about one of those prison visits when Vladdy's dad got angry and threw her and kicked her in the ribs. She says the prison guard just stood there. But she built a life of her own, too, and made ends meet.
Trabajé en un super.
She worked at a supermarket and sewed tights in a factory. And she was really into lifting weights. She showed me this video where she's at this competition. She's petite but strong, wearing black shorts and hot pink sneakers. And you see her prep herself to lift this huge barbell. Life's so different now in California, and Vladdy's not here with her. It's unthinkable sometimes, but she always meant to send for him once she figured out a place for them to live. When she crossed the border, she was detained for 7 months, but as soon as she got out, she started thinking about getting Vladdy here. When she heard about the big migrant caravan, she told him to join it.
Sí la veía como una opción.
It'd be safer with a group of migrants and not a smuggler, but she still worried about him the whole time.
Todos los días.
¿En un día cuántas veces?
4 o 5 veces.
No más que podía.
Y estaba escribiendo, ¿dónde están? Cuando tenían señal me contestaban, cuando no era horrible porque yo estaba, Dios mío, ¿cómo estará?
They talked 4 or 5 times every day. If he didn't call, she tried not to panic. She was really anxious when Vladdy crossed into Mexico from Guatemala on a raft made of tires and wood. When he finally reached the U.S. border, she was relieved, but knew it'd be harder for him to get across. It was getting tougher.
Para recuperarnos y tal vez por regresar en clave para que se pueda tener atención médica ahí a los que se ocupen.
The week we meet, U.S. Border Patrol agents tear gassed migrants on the border. President Trump sent troops there, and thousands of migrants in the caravan Vladdy came up in were stuck in Mexico.
Y es muy preocupada, un dolor en mi pecho. De saber dónde estaba mi hijo, de cómo estaba, si ya había comido.
Veronica says her chest physically hurts, wondering how he's doing, whether he's eaten. She hasn't seen him since she left El Salvador more than a year ago.
Tengo fe en Dios que todo va a estar bien. Solo hay que saber esperar.
I have faith in God, it'll all be fine. I just have to wait. Back in Tijuana, people are mobilizing to help migrants like Vladdy. Not far from his shelter, there's a building filled with volunteers. People are hauling donated water bottles, tents, and tampons.
Okay. Fourth floor?
I'm looking for a lawyer named Nicole Ramos. She's connecting other lawyers to migrants.
How do you explain what you're doing here?
We're essentially doing legal triage. We are providing refugees with information about the U.S. legal system.
I ask about Vladdy.
He's 15 years old. He's here alone. His mom is in the United States. What are some of the scenarios that he faces?
He would attempt to present himself at the port of entry
in Tijuana,
where you would enter the United States at the San Ysidro port of entry. He would get to the gate, and most likely he would be met by U.S. Customs and Border Patrol officers who would then turn him away.
She's trying to prevent that. I ask Ramos why she thinks the government is pushing back so hard at the border.
Because the U.S. government simply does not want any more immigrants.
The Department of Homeland Security and Customs and Border Protection declined my interview requests. But I talked to Andrew Arthur, a former immigration judge, about all this. He has a different take on why people are being turned away. He says it's about capacity.
There's a physical constraint, a space constraint. The ability to actually build additional screening areas would be a significant undertaking. And so you can send more asylum officers down there, but you're just not going to have the space capacity in order to screen those individuals at the ports of entry.
I bring up Vladdy and how his family's threatened by gangs.
He needs to resist that. He needs to go to the police and tell the police about the harm that he's suffered.
Oftentimes they say, you hear the police are involved with the gangs themselves and that the police won't help. What would you say to him then?
Then you'd go to a higher level police officer or alternatively seek relocation within the country.
Vladdy and his mom did move to another part of El Salvador, though, and they say they still weren't safe, which is why he's here in Tijuana. For now, Vladdy's killing time at the shelter until the lawyers say it's time to cross. He's playing with this kitten the kids here rescued off the street.
Migra.
Migra. A ver, di algo. Di algo, pues, di algo.
He's on his phone a lot, playing games and watching videos.
Uno se llama Clash of Clans y el otro Free Fire. Y también me gusta ver videos en Facebook. Son anime, se llama más, sí.
¿Qué tipo de videos en Facebook? What kind of videos do you like to watch on Facebook?
Se llaman anime, son como caricaturas.
¿De Japón?
Sí, son japoneses.
He's really into the Japanese anime videos.
After dinner one night, Vladdy and I talk about the future.
When you think of the United States, what do you think of?
Pues es un país grande y poderoso y lleno de inmigrantes y pues Estados Unidos yo diría que no es lo que es gracias solo a los
that the United States is a big country and it's a country of immigrants.
La economía de ahí porque
I ask him how he pictures life if he makes it to the U.S.
Quiero estudiar porque el estudio lo es todo.
He says he'll go to high school.
Tenía que tener buenas notas o si no el teléfono me lo quita.
I have to get good grades or my mom will take away my cell. I believe it from getting to know Veronica. She's tough. But he wants to see her more than anything after more than a year apart.
Es mi mamá y que siempre va a hacer falta eso, sí. Ella siempre me ha cuidado bastante y pues me hace bastante falta.
Claro. Says he's looking forward to seeing his mom, giving her a hug, living with her again.
That evening, one of Vladdy's friends pulls him aside, this young guy from Honduras. He takes out this little plastic bag with a metal chain inside.
It's a cross on the end of his chain. His friend's putting it on him.
It looks like a blessing. His friend says Vladdy will need all the luck he can get to make it to the U.S. Back in California, Veronica gets the news that Vladdy's made it through. U.S. officials call from the border. Your son is here with us.
Ya me llamaron para comunicarme con él, ya hablé con él.
She said she is so much more relaxed to know that he's here in the United States. They've spoken. He said he's fine.
And now she waits to see when he'll be released from the holding cell at the border. I call a few days later to see if she's heard from him again.
Aquí sigo esperando. No, sigo esperando.
Wow, hoy es día 3.
Dice que puede ser que me llamen hasta una semana.
No, no word. Veronica says she was told maybe it'd take a week for a call. More days pass.
We're listening to a story by the world's Monica Campbell. It's about a 15-year-old boy from El Salvador named Vladdy making his way to the U.S. to be with his mom in California. Where we left off, Vladdy's mom, Veronica, knew he was in U.S. custody, but she hadn't heard from him.
I check in with Veronica again.
We know where he is?
Sí. Se encuentra en Miami, Florida.
In Miami?
Sí.
¿Y cómo está?
Lejos, ¿verdad?
Veronica laughs because it's so absurd to her that she's in California and now Vladdy's in Florida, ping-ponging around the country. He's even had his first trip on an airplane courtesy of U.S. immigration officials. He's joining an estimated 10,000-plus other young migrants in federal custody, waiting for the government to decide what to do with them.
Aunque me dijo que estaba cansado, pero está bien.
She says he's tired, but fine. At least he's not being held at the border anymore. Veronica's been there, in the cells that migrants call iceboxes. But now a new chapter begins, another wait, to see when Vladdy can leave Florida. Nearly 2 weeks pass with Vladdy in Florida. It's almost Christmas. Vladdy calls Veronica from the shelter. They speak twice a week, 10 minutes each call.
Hola,
hola, hijo, ¿cómo está?
Mal.
¿Por qué?
Pues no tenía que estar enfermo.
Vladdy's sick, says he's achy, feels like he's got a fever. I ask Vladdy how many kids are there with him.
Supuestamente hay más de mil.
Más de mil.
More than 1,000. Does he know the name of the shelter?
Shelter.
No, pero digo el nombre completo.
Pues no sé, yo lo por shelter lo conozco.
Shelter, he says. I said, no, that's shelter in English. Do you know the name of the shelter? No, he says he doesn't. I ask him how long some of the other teens have been there.
¿Y conoce a muchachos allá que han tenido cuánto tiempo allá? ¿Que han llevado cuánto tiempo?
Ah, pues aquí hay unos que tienen 4 meses.
4 months. Vladdy says he's meeting kids detained for 4 months. Then Vladdy's case manager wants to talk to Veronica.
Hola, buenos días. ¿Cómo
está? She tells Veronica, good news. They just need her fingerprints, and she's done with the background check for reuniting with Vladdy. But bad news. Veronica has to go to Los Angeles tomorrow to get fingerprinted.
Oh, my God.
Veronica's eyes fill with tears. It seems like a blip. Just go to L.A. and get fingerprints. But it's a big deal. Veronica barely has any money, so she needs to take a Greyhound overnight from Oakland to L.A., about 11 hours. She'll do that so she doesn't have to pay for a hotel. But she's also supposed to have her monthly check-in with immigration officials tomorrow in San Francisco, so she has to be in two places at once.
Sí, voy.
Sí, voy, she says. Yes, I'll go. So Veronica took this really long bus trip overnight to L.A. to be fingerprinted. Incredible story. I've got so many questions. Let me turn to reporter Monica Campbell herself to talk about what happened. And Monica, there is a late-breaking update to Vladdy's story, which you'll tell us about in a moment. But just picking up the ball with when the government got Veronica's fingerprints, did they then release Vladdy?
No, they didn't. It actually kind of continued like that for several more weeks. In fact, it seemed that every time I checked in with Veronica, there was another document or bit of information that the government was requesting from her. For example, they wanted a picture of the house that she was staying in, there that she is staying in Pinole, just north of San Francisco, because it wasn't showing up on the GPS reader on the government side. So she, you know, scrambles, gets a photo, sends the photo, and it just seemed like that was the norm week after week. And I would like to note that the government also required that the American couple that she's living with also had to get fingerprinted kind of late in the game. And that was something that was unexpected because apparently not everybody has to be fingerprinted in the household these days. But it's unsure how that policy plays out.
Monica, you mentioned that Vladdy is one of 10,000 kids in U.S. custody right now. So are there 10,000 variations on Vladdy's story? Like, are there ways in which you'd say Vladdy is pretty typical?
Yeah, it's one story, but in some ways, I think Vladdy's story does represent a lot of what we see, you know, that these kids face who are in detention, in federal custody. They've got loved ones in the United States who are going through all the hoops and trying to hustle and make reunification happen as quickly as possible. At the same time, in this particular case, Veronica has a pending asylum case, so she is protected from deportation to an extent. Mm. I'm thinking about a lot of kids in detention and shelters who have parents or loved ones who are completely undocumented and don't have an asylum case pending, who may be fearful of the U.S. immigration officials getting their information and possibly then facing deportation themselves. So it's incredibly tricky, and a lot of families are facing really hard decisions about what to do when kids are in detention.
You've reported on migration and detention and family separation for years, Monica. In this reporting, were there things that you learned or that struck you in a different way?
Yeah, I was really struck following Veronica's day-to-day wait for her son. I'm a new parent, and I couldn't imagine, you know, parenting through such an extreme circumstance, putting your kid on a path that, you know, maybe, you know, she says is the best thing for him in the long run. But that journey was so unpredictable. Just seeing Veronica sitting by her and watching that roller coaster and feeling it through her
was incredible. I had never experienced that in all my years of immigration reporting, just the day-to-day tedium and stress. Mm-hmm. And I was really grateful for Veronica allowing me to kind of be with her through this process.
And you worked on Vladdy and his mom Veronica's story for months, but last night there was a very last-minute update, right?
Right. Veronica called, and by the end of today, Vladdy and his mom will be reunited. She got word he's flying into L.A., and it's going to be, you know, more of a roller coaster, but, you know, I'll definitely keep you guys updated.
Still, what a great conclusion to a really tough story. Wishing them both a happy reunion and a happy future. And The World's Monica Campbell, thanks to you for telling their story.
Thank you.
That was The World's Monica Campbell. Her story, The Boy in the Caravan, was produced in partnership with PBS Frontline's podcast, The Frontline Dispatch. You can hear the whole story and see pictures of Vladdy and Veronica at theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.